Which birthday?
19th, isn't it?
Yeah,
19th. That's number three.
So I like to think she came home for Mother's Day. Came home on Sunday, but I think it was more for the birthday, really.
No more further ado. I'm going to hand over to Steve. And
good evening, everybody. I'm absolutely in awe of you guys. Who really wants to talk about despair and depression? Yet you've come out. We're absolutely thrilled that the Bible talks very realistically about every element of human experience, and it will put a spin on that that some would say are alternative, others would just say is almost otherworldly. And we want to simply be able to present that to you in a way that hopefully will connect a little bit with your story. I realise that many people in this room will have some sort of encounter with an unwanted emotional state that is often known as depression. It has tendencies towards despair. And one of the things that, as I've spoken and worked with a lot of people who face depression, I've come to be aware is that nobody ever asks for that emotion. Joy, yes. Exhilaration, yes. Thrill, happiness. But nobody puts depression there on there. Do you know, I really feel like I need to experience that before I die. And usually when it comes as a total surprise. It's very difficult to make sense of. We ask questions like, why me? And why is it there? And one of the things that's helpful as we begin to explore that is just to be able to hear a story about that. Now, I realise that whenever you use that word depression, that's a very personal thing for you. And for Jane, she has her personal experience of that, which may well be different to one that's brushed your life, either with a loved one or something that you've had to face, either on an occasion or seasonally in your own life. So I'm going to try and speak and talk about this as respectfully as I can, realising that these are things that are very precious and very close to who we are and what we've expected out of life. So Jane and I, we've been married for, is it nearly 24 years? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm going to ask Jane a little bit about her experiences that sort of came on her as a total shock. Roundabout, maybe it's not a shock to you, but roundabout 5 or 6 weeks after we got married. Okay, so tell us a little bit about what you were like as a teenager, what sort of things excited you, what sort of things you wanted to be involved in, what sort of things you did.
Well, all my family were quite like high achieving sort of family. I went to a good school, got really good grades, was really sort of keen to be involved in every possible aspect of life that I could be, and generally did quite well at most of the things that I did. What else?
And that was something that didn't just happen. You were very applied to that, weren't you?
Yeah, I guess so. I think I had a ridiculously overachieving big sister, and so I always wanted to try and sort of catch up with her, do as well as she did.
Are you competitive?
Yeah.
Just a little bit. Yeah. And you went off, you'd originally thought about possibly going to Oxford, Cambridge. You'd sort of been provisionally offered a place, and then things didn't quite go well at at the end of A-levels. How did that feel for you?
I think that was just because my sister got in and she did go to Cambridge, and then I didn't. So I sort of felt a little bit like not as good as her. Even though I did just as well in my exams and stuff and everything as her, but I just always felt like I was comparing myself.
And of course you came from a loving home though. Your mum and dad, they provided for you in loads of ways, and also one as part of that, they shared something of their hope in Jesus Christ with you. And tell us a little bit about how you came to a point where you decided to ask Jesus Christ to be a part of your life.
Okay. So because my parents were Christians and I was taken along to church every Sunday, I just grew up knowing all the stories. I grew up just believing that there was a God, because that was how I'd been brought up, and so that was just always in everything that we thought about. And I think it was when I was six that I was in church one time and somebody was preaching, and I think I realized at that point that I was never going to be good enough for God, and so I needed Jesus. And so, you know, there wasn't a whole lot you could understand when you're six, but I understood enough to know that I needed Jesus to be my saviour. As I got older, that obviously I added to that in terms of the stuff that I learned about God, ways that I got to know him. But I think a lot of the way my faith was lived out was by trying to do the right thing. So I was really sure that I couldn't get to heaven without Jesus, that I couldn't be good enough for God without Jesus, and I needed him to for my salvation. But I just took on, without really realizing that that's what I was taking on, the idea that yes, Jesus is enough to get me to heaven, but in terms of actually pleasing God now, that's down to me. And so, yeah, if he's going to be pleased with me, then I had to work really hard. I had to do the best I could. I had to, you know, just be loving to other people. And I think was under a whole lot of pressure of my own making because of that. I don't think that's what my parents ever taught me. You know, they certainly taught us about grace, which is, for those of you who don't know, grace is when the Lord offers you something that you don't deserve. And so I think I knew that my place in heaven was something that I didn't deserve, that the Lord offered me, but I still had to, I don't know, just work really hard to please him in the short term.
And that's something of a disconnect that probably put you under quite a lot of pressure. Were you conscious of that pressure at the time?
Yeah, I was. I was conscious of it because I was always aware of the fact that I wasn't quite as good as the person I wanted to be, and I wasn't as good as the person I pretended to be as well. So what I was really like in my heart was not necessarily the same as the what came out of my mouth and what came out of my actions.
Did that exhaust you in any way?
Yeah, it did, because I was constantly feeling like I was a failure, because I was a failure in so many different areas, even though I wasn't. I was doing well academically, and you know, Jesus had saved me and I was headed for heaven, but at the same time I just felt like a failure because I wasn't as good as my big sister. I wasn't as good as what I thought other Christian families looked like they were like. You know, it looked like they never got anything wrong.
That sounds like a recipe for emotional pressure.
Yeah, but I don't think I realised that it was at that point. At that point I was just getting on with life, just trying hard in everything all the time.
And you went to university, not the one you wanted to go to.
Mm-hmm.
How did your university life go?
Well, I went off the rails, really, the first little bit of university. I think my background at home had been sort of quite restrictive in terms of what I was and wasn't allowed to do. And then all of a sudden, I was at university, I could do whatever I wanted. Discovered by partying. And so went a bit mad for a bit. But I was never really happy with that, because I knew that that wasn't what God wanted for me. But it drew me in a way that was really hard to get out of. But I was miserable the whole time, because that wasn't who I wanted to be.
And what were some of the things that were valuable to you at the time? What were you hoping for out of life? What were you hoping life would bring along for you?
I was definitely a romantic at heart. I'd read far too many like Thomas Hardy and Bronte novels.
Any Thomas Hardy or Bronte fans out there? Yeah, you hopeless romantics, that's going to get you into all kinds of trouble.
It's largely because we didn't have a telly and I wasn't allowed to watch telly, so therefore I read every book I could get my hand on instead. And the Penguin Classics, you could get them for £1 at the time, so I'd buy, you know, a few every week and just read my way through all of those. But that meant that I just swallowed the idea of happiness means that you find this wonderful partner and you get married and then everything is great.
Would you say that was a hope of yours?
Yeah, I think, yeah. So I'd sometimes look at my parents and I'd see that they weren't always happy, but then I just assumed, oh, that was just them, and actually it would be fine.
We'd make it work.
We'd make it work, yeah.
And did you find this perfect partner?
Well, what happened was I found somebody who wasn't perfect, who wasn't a Christian, and was going out with him for a while, but all the time feeling like this wasn't really what was best for me, because our lives were headed in different directions. I wanted to live for the Lord and he didn't. It was never really going to work. But I was too scared to get out of the relationship because I felt dependent on him. I just thought that having somebody who loved me was the be all and end all. And so I couldn't bear the thought of being without him. So for ages, I wanted to finish it, but didn't feel like I could. Eventually, I did. And then very soon after that, as in like a matter of weeks, I noticed this one. And he was a Christian, and it looked like he might have me, so I thought that would do.
It's basically anything that moved, occasionally went to church and wore trousers, would do.
Pretty much, yeah.
And was this going to be deliver your fairy tale romantic ideal life, finding somebody to love you, and then a lot of those insecurities would pass
away?
Yeah,
I think because I'd sort of, my life had been a bit of a mess, and I'd kind of like, just that first year at university, just going mad, not working as hard as I could be, throwing blessings away, really. And so sort of putting that aside and turning round to say to the Lord, yeah, you know, I want to come back to you, and I want somebody who is going to help me to do that, and I thought Steve was. So I think because I thought that other relationship was so wrong for me, and this one looked like it was going to be so right, therefore it would be great.
And will you say you put a bit of hope in that?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And then you're coming into your third year. We got engaged whilst at university, and we actually got married on the very last day of university, and we have the wedding photos to prove it, with all these people who are just coming out of student life and haven't got a clue how to dress for a wedding. And you look back, it's absolutely hilarious. But in the run-up to that, you've got your final year project, you've got the prospect of getting married, you've got the prospect of moving house and learning to live with somebody.
Like just those few months then, when I had come back to the Lord, I then just like wanted to throw my life into serving him. And so I'd spend sort of like all my evenings, you know, meeting up with first year students who were Christians who needed some support or things like that. So I like, and the course I was doing was very demanding in the third year. So I'd be up at the crack of dawn, I'd be off into university, I'd be in my lab for 8 hours, and then I'd come home, and then I'd be doing all the Christian Union work, sort of like talking to other people and supporting them. And then by about sort of 11 o'clock at night, then it's like, okay, now I need to actually do some uni work. So then I'd start doing that. So I just never slept. And thought I was doing great because it looked like I was doing all the right things. But I think obviously I was digging a pit for myself.
And then we got married and we moved in together. How did that go the first couple of weeks?
Not great.
How would you describe honeymoon? Was it in a Thomas Hardy novel?
No. We started arguing just before we got married, and then basically didn't stop arguing for the next 5 or 6 years, probably.
Yeah, that's right. She said 5 or 6 years, not 5 or 6 days.
Yeah. We had a really awful time of it. I think we'd argue over absolutely everything, but whatever we argued about, it always came down to the same thing. So we argue about the way we argue. And I was needy and emotional, and you were an arrogant upstart who thought you knew everything. So
a toxic combination, one, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And obviously, this wasn't your dream ending, what you'd hoped for. You've worked hard, you've applied yourself. You're also emotionally exhausted, circumstantially exhausted.
It looked like we'd made a big mistake, but there was no way out of it because we'd made the vow.
And that terrified you.
We stuck with it, yeah.
And you suddenly noticed a shift and a change in your mood and your physicality about 6 or 7 weeks on after that, which sort of caught you by surprise. Do you want to tell everybody a bit about that?
What, physical stuff as well?
Can do, yeah.
Yeah, so, like I said before, I used to do loads of sport and everything, and then when...
Sorry, I should say this. Without any training, 3 weeks before we got married, she won the University Ladies 1500 metre championship without even training, okay? And I'm like, I've found a winner. She's like excellent at everything and she'll put up with me. But of course, that'll only go so far, won't it?
Yeah. So then I think just like the stress of everything. So all those months of not sleeping enough, trying to do everything right. Preparing a wedding whilst doing finals, and then not having a whole lot of money either to plan the wedding with, because we were students and all that, I think it just basically ended up in me having a sort of like a breakdown. To describe it, it was just physically and mentally exhausted. To the point where I didn't want to get up in the morning, and even the times when I felt like I did want to get up, I just felt physically like I couldn't as well. And so it was just such a shock to the system, because I'd always been someone who was just naturally good at everything.
It's worth saying that her teenage nickname, because it describes the way she just did life, her nickname, and I still call her this, you're not allowed to, I can. Nickname is Tigger from Winnie the Pooh. That was how you'd experience Jane. And then suddenly, within almost a matter of hours, Tigger's gone.
Yeah.
And how? A lot of the time you were numb. But tell us a little bit about some of the self-talk that went on in your head as you were facing this.
I just couldn't understand what was happening, because I'd never felt... yeah, like this before. So sort of like despair of thinking, I can't fix this. Everything that I've always done before in the life, it's like been in my power to do something about it. And this feeling, this difficult marriage, this just feeling like every aspect of life was miserable and there was nothing I could do about it.
No hope.
Yeah.
And as you looked forward into the future, what did you see?
I couldn't see it getting any better. I just thought I'd always be like that.
So when it came to things like responsibilities, work, we'd started volunteering in youth and children's stuff. We got family to visit. We'd got a house to sort out. How did you feel about the prospect of doing anything?
I just wanted to hide away from everything, because I just felt like whatever I tried to do, it wouldn't be good enough. And so I'd rather just hide so people didn't see me. So I just wanted to stay at home.
And that the physical element surprised you as well, because you had quite a lot of nerve pain.
Yeah.
We got married in the June. By the November, she had been taken into a neurological unit because she couldn't physically move her head from one side of the pillow to the other. She was totally immobile. Did nerve conduction tests and...
kept saying that nothing was wrong.
They were saying, physically, there is nothing that is wrong with you, but yeah. It seems as if your body just totally shut down. And in that, in the midst of facing all of that, you'd gone in, been highly motivated, you'd gone into marriage hoping that to some degree it would deliver you to your promised land. All of that is sitting with feeling like it's in tatters. How are you feeling about yourself?
Just even more of a failure than I was. Than I used to feel before.
Mm. And that's the end of the story. Good night. No, it was a long period, and I got to watch you battle against that. You weren't happy. You didn't want to feel like this.
Didn't want to battle it though. Couldn't be bothered. It was like too much effort.
I just wanted
to give in to it, because it just felt like every effort that I put in would reap such small rewards. It was hardly worth the effort.
It's like getting up and climbing Mount Everest every day. Why bother?
Yeah, just to go to church on a Sunday, when knowing that I'd be sit there and I'd be so miserable that I wouldn't take a word in. So what's the point in going? Same with meeting up with friends. I wouldn't know what to say to them. I'm just going to be miserable. So what's the point of even going in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so suddenly your life is feeling and looking very different to what you thought it would 12 months earlier, even 6 months earlier.
Yeah.
You're obviously not there now. What were some of the things that began to shift and change, both in circumstances, because clearly there was circumstantial pressures, but also, you know, you seem to have brought something of who you are into this, and it made a bit of a nasty cocktail there.
Mm.
Tell us a little bit about that.
We used to, like, the church that we went to when we were first married was a church called Bridge Chapel up in Liverpool, and the pastor Bill Bygraves, who used to speak, he was really big on grace. And I remember when I first started going to his church, it used to make me angry because I felt like he was saying that you didn't have to be godly, you didn't have to be pure, you didn't have to be holy, you didn't have to be a good person. That's how kind of how I heard what he was saying, and it's like, it's okay because the Lord will forgive you anyway. And so it took me a really long time, like years, to kind of get to grips with what that really meant.
So can we unpack this concept of grace a little bit for people who may not be familiar with it? So grace is, on the basis of somebody else's riches, you receive what you don't deserve, and you're not just receiving but accepted. You're given a standing, you're given a welcome into the family, not so much on the basis of what you do, but on the basis of what that other person has done.
Yeah.
And of course, the center of that story, if any of you guys like U2, they've got an amazing song called Grace. Go and look it up on iTunes or whatever you listen to. And Bono puts it in a way that I never could. But effectively, grace carries the pain and removes the stain, and gives us a sense of hope and identity, not based in ourselves, but on the basis of the merits of another. That's what grace brings. And of course, grace in the Christian faith is built and born around the historical person of Jesus Christ, the only one who is a big enough heavyweight to be able to give us grace. And if you don't know any of the stories that reveal that in the Bible to us, that in a way that causes our soul to sing, please make sure you take away the little Luke's gospel, because on every page you'll see the grace of Jesus moving towards needy people, people many of whom mean well but realize they're not enough. And that was something of a discovery that you made. You told other people about grace, hadn't you? But you hadn't...
So I believed it in my head, but I didn't really believe it in my heart, because I always felt that I had to keep on being this person that I knew I couldn't be, but I kept thinking I had to.
But it's almost as if you had to hit rock bottom before you'd even start to consider that.
Yeah. There were some circumstantial things that happened that made it a little bit easier to cope with. Like, I got pregnant by accident, and to Steve, that was just an absolute disaster. You know, his wife's already in tatters, and now she's pregnant as well. How on earth are we going to cope with this? Whereas for me, it was just so exciting. It was brilliant. And that, it gave me something to focus on, I think, in a positive way. And so that helped. But obviously that didn't fix what was going on inside. It just meant I had a reason to get out of bed in the morning. And that's...
It was a gift
at the time. And that... I think also, like, hormones and everything, change and everything, that helped just me physically recover a little bit, although not fully. I'd say that whole physical recovery probably took about 10 years, didn't it?
You'd also got some help from medical profession, so they tried you on various medications at different seasons. Tell us a little bit about your story with that.
It was a few different medications that I was put on. The one that helped most was Prozac. And what that did, it didn't fix any of what was going on inside. So it didn't help with, the emotional blackness the sense of failure. It didn't deal with any of that, but what it did do is it kind of puts you on a slightly more emotional even keel. So rather than, you know, having sort of like mood swings like this up and down each day, what the Prozac did for me was made me a bit more like this, which meant then it's easier then to talk about what's really going on. So I think the work was done in me through talking it through with other Christians over many, many, many years, rather than the medication. But if the medication just sort of like helps you to be stable enough to be able to do that, if you see what I mean.
And you've carried on benefiting from that seasonally, mm-hmm. through life. Mm-hmm. And obviously sometimes there are things that have come in that have been pretty difficult, really. So nearly six years ago, you had a life-altering cycling accident.
Yeah.
And you probably can't tell this right now, but Jane hasn't got her own shoulder. She's had to have it reconstructed, and she's left with very limited shoulder function, permanent pain. How did you face that unwanted situation, difficulty, differently to, say, the version of you 15 years before that?
Well, interestingly, before that happened, I'd just been going through a phase of just being dissatisfied with where we were in life at that point. Just being...
Anybody ever been there?
I've always been a... Well, no, I haven't. Like, I used to be a glass half full person until I married him, and then I became a glass half empty person. And and I think... Sorry, what was I saying? Oh, yeah. And I'd realised that I was just being negative about lots of things in life, which were actually good things. You know, I had some great kids. We had by this point, we were getting on, you know, pretty well. You know, lots of good things
pretty
in life.
Pretty well.
But I was...
We're head over heels. It just Thomas Hardy just took 10 years longer than you thought.
15.
15, okay, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, and so there'd been a few times that I'd prayed and I'd asked the Lord to teach me to be content, and I really didn't expect it to happen the way that it did. But, yeah, having a really bad accident and then spending months not being able to move at all, I had to sleep sitting up downstairs because I just couldn't bear any movement at all for months and months. And then through all that period of time, I started to see good things in my life that had been there all along, but I'd not noticed them before. So, like, how much our church family loved us and cared for us. What a family our church was. I'd only ever been able to see all the negative things. And I don't really know quite why God used that experience to show me that the way he did. But it really did show me a different way of looking at life. To appreciate small things, to be grateful for the gifts that you're given, both now and in eternity.
And I'm just aware that you're speaking there with a very personal language about a living God who is present and is involved in our lives. And, you know, perhaps for some people here, that almost sounds a little bit fanciful or a strange interpretation, but you seem to be pretty confident. Tell us a little bit about the grounds of your confidence there.
I'm 100% certain that it's true, that there is a God, that he made me, that he made everything in this world. He made us for a purpose, which is to enjoy his creation and to enjoy him. And we mess that up in so many ways. And so he actually then sent Jesus for us to fix what we've broken, and take the punishment on him instead of us. And I really believe that. And over my life, you know, the last sort of 39 years since I was six and I first had that knowledge of what God had done, it's just been a growing and deepening relationship with the Lord, where I'll talk to him about anything that goes on in my life.
And if somebody else was like, well, how can you be so sure? How can you be so confident? I mean, obviously we're giving out these gospels, which are a love letter from Christians believe, from the living God to us about his son, the Lord Jesus. Is this simply, obviously you've spoken passionately there. You've told something of the big picture of the Bible story. If there was somebody who wanted to be able to evaluate that for themselves and say, hold on, is this just pie in the sky when you die? Is this real? Is this just fanciful thinking? How would you suggest to them that they went about making an evaluation and looking into the credibility of this themselves?
There's all sorts of things that you can do. So that, I mean, if you've got questions as to whether Jesus was who he said he was, there's actually so much evidence if you look into history, not just into the Bible, but you know, other historians who were around at the time, just to show that it's true. But also just experientially, as you read about Jesus, and as you learn more about him, it changes you. You know, I believe that the Bible is God's word; it's living and active, and it, as you read it, it's the Lord speaking directly to your soul. And I know that to be true. I know that like millions of times through my life, when you know there's been something that I've been facing, you know, and I've turned to God's word, and the answer's just like, it's hit me straight in the face. And it's just like, there's too many occasions like that for it to have been a coincidence. So I think all those things adding up over time then gets to the point where I go looking for that, because I believe that that's what's going to happen. I believe that there is an answer to everything that I'm facing.
Can I ask you just one more question then, just before we wrap up this part of the evening? Some people will be sitting here and they'll have loved ones, people who they really care about, who are facing a season or perhaps maybe long-term period of despair and depression. They'll probably be feeling powerless because they just want to love on that loved one. What would you say to them? Could you give us maybe one or two little tips on how to love and care for somebody who's struggling through a season of depression?
I think some of the people who helped the most were people who didn't ask anything of me, but just served. So like one particular lady who would come around and she would just like hoover my house. She even like moved the couch and hoovered behind the couch, which I thought was incredible at the time. I'd just been a student for 3 years. And yeah, it little things like that. So she was there for me to talk to when I felt I wanted to talk, but she never kind of forced me to talk when I wasn't ready to. Yeah. So that, it was always more helpful when people didn't ask me what was wrong, because I didn't know what was wrong. So that just feel even more of a failure for not being able to explain it. So someone, you know, I think, yeah, sometimes people just would come and just be with us and just sit and watch a film with me or something, but without asking what was wrong, because I couldn't answer that.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Well, listen, we've worked you hard. Thank you ever so much for your honesty on that. We're going to invite Simon up to tell us what we're going to do next.